I too want to refer to Mr. Jefferson. You know, we'd have to quote on the wall. It's amazing. And to actually one of his friends, a close colleague for some years until I had a terrible break, John Randolph, Randolph of Roma. He was a Jeffersonian until about 1803, when he and Jefferson broke over Randolph's more strident version of states' rights. Randolph was a member of Congress, member of the Senate, minister to Russia, etc., etc. But he's famous for a particular simple quotation, which I think is my way of saying something about last night's election results. The quote is, "I love liberty, but I hate equality. I love liberty, but I hate equality." Now, Randolph was a slaveholder, an aristocrat. There's a simple level on which we might understand that quote in its context. But I think I'd submit that we may not need the humanities to understand the first part. I love liberty. I love what's mine. Instinctively. I mean, the cognitive scientists now, who, with their multi-million dollar grants, are telling us a great deal about how we think from our nature. Our nature is pretty well prepared, it appears, to love our liberty, our individual liberty. But it's not very prepared to love equality. That's a very different proposition. How do people even begin to learn how to love equality? It's such a new idea in the history of the world, if you think about it. We barely had two or three centuries of seriously even talking about it. I mean, it's in the epistles of Paul, and it's in ancient texts in certain ways, but in public discourse. It's always been easy to love our own individual liberty, but not as easy to love spreading around. When I voted yesterday for the second time, I carried Frederick Douglass's narrative into the booth with me. And for the second time, Douglass voted for Obama. back in May or June, I'm an advisor to the 9/11 Museum down the street, which just had a terrible flood right after the beginning to finally do construction again and finish the place. And it's because of my work on memory. At any rate, the New York Times did an online debate. They were trying to get about five or six of us to argue in an online forum about how to think about the origins of 9/11. How do we help the public understand how did this happen? And I won't name any of the other participants. I was one of two historians. Most of the people were policy people who kept weighing in on this. And they kept trying to get us to argue. So finally we did. And the argument was about, so where do we begin the story of 9/11? Where do you it's an origin story. Where do you start it? So it's fun, right? And one of the people said, now the place to really start this is in the post-Cold War 1990s. He was a policy person who doesn't do a lot of history. And another guy said, no, we got to go back at least to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. It's the Soviet war in Afghanistan. That's where the origins really are. And here, it's a good argument to actually place the museum tends to begin. They got to start somewhere with a limited space. Start the narrative there. It makes great sense. That's how Al-Qaeda came into existence and so on and so forth. And back and forth and back and forth. And I sort of got perverse at one point. I got a little tired of this as a historian. So I just said one day, I think we should start with the Trojan War. And the other people weighing in said, come on. No, I said, no. Why not? You really want people to understand this is not new. 9/11 is not unprecedented. It's not new. Want to understand why people have slaughtered other people? Let's go back far. But James Baldwin suggested we should go back even further. There's this Why do we need the humanities? I can't think of a better reason than it always helps us understand how old things are, how old every question is, how old every problem is. There's this line in Baldwin's novel, by the way, James Baldwin, who adored this building, who grew up at 131st and Park Avenue, Uptown Park Avenue, as he called it, in Harlem, oldest of 9 children, dire poverty, loved books, as he recounts it, had read everything there was to read in the Harlem Public Library, and at about age 12 or 13, he started coming down here. And he tells those stories of how the policemen out here would tell him, hey boy, they don't let niggers in there. That's the way he wrote it. But he came in anyway, and he tells us, he sat in the reading room here and read Uncle Tom's Cabin. I mean, how great is that? Anyway, in Another Country, his third novel, principal protagonist is a man named David, and they're in this debate about why is the world full of evil, or what's human nature, and he has his character David say, they're debating actually, finally, the meaning of the Garden of Eden. That's even older than the Trojan War, last I looked. And he has David say, perhaps life offers only the choice of remembering the garden or forgetting it. Either or. It takes strength to remember. It takes another kind of strength to forget. It takes a hero to do both. People who remember court madness through the pain of the perpetually recurring death of their own innocence. People who forget court another kind of madness, and the world is mostly divided between madmen who remember and madmen who forget. Heroes are rare. The humanities is the way, the place we have to go, it seems to me, to understand that most human of dilemmas, which is, how do we remember and forget? How do we have a past that we can actually live with, when we sometimes know that past is something we can't live with? How do we figure out how to remember or forget? At any rate, I could go on, but I won't. I was told 5 minutes, so I better stop. I think the only point I want to make as a historian about great libraries like this, or about the entire enterprise of education, which I've been doing all my life, is that it's the humanities we have to go to know how old everything really is. And by the way, James Baldwin once, if you know Baldwin at all, you know he always shot from the hip. He could be a terrifying interview. And he did hundreds and hundreds of interviews with the press, and TV, and a lot of them on YouTube, if you want to look them up. But he was once being interviewed by Studs Terkel, and Terkel could make his interviewee finally speak straight. And Baldwin was ranting on, as he always did, about Americans don't have any sense of history. They don't know their history. They don't know their history. You know, he had a point. Finally, Terkel said, well, but Mr. Baldwin, what does it actually mean to have a sense of history? And this one's actually on YouTube. You can actually see Baldwin kind of stop, quiet for a moment, look back at Terkel, and he said, well, it means that you know you're not alone. One of the simplest definitions of a sense of history I've ever heard. It means you know you're not alone. And what can that mean, particularly for young people?